This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Sunday said the current hostilities in Gaza and Israel are utterly appalling, calling for an immediate end to the fighting between two sides. Speaking at a Security Council meeting on the current situation in the Middle East, the UN chief appealed to all parties to heed his call. He said the United Nations was actively engaging all sides towards an immediate ceasefire. He reiterated that the United Nations remain deeply committed to working with Israelis and Palestinians and with the international and regional partners, including the Middle East Quartet, to realize lasting and just peace. Members of a militia opposed to the coup by the Myanmar military Sunday pulled back into the jungle of western Myanmar following days of fighting with the army, as the United States and Britain condemned military violence against civilians. Mendat, a city of about 40,000 people in the western Chin state of Myanmar, has become a hotspot for the civilian movement against the military government, which seized power in a coup February 1st. The United Nations has estimated that the military has killed more than 780 people since the coup. The military disputes that number. The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is defending the decision to ease mask-wearing guidance for fully vaccinated people, stressing that increasing political pressure had nothing to do with the abrupt shift in guidelines. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky told Fox News Sunday that she delivered the science as soon as it was available. To date, more than 156 million Americans, or more than 47% of the population, have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine, and more than 121 million are fully vaccinated. This is VOA News. Children are having their noses swabbed or saliva sampled at a school to test for the coronavirus in U.S. cities such as Baltimore, New York, and Chicago. Now, the parts of the U.S. school districts are reluctant to check even students showing signs of illness for COVID-19. Education and health officials around the country have taken different approaches to testing students and staff members in widely varying positions or whether to test them at all. Officials in districts that have embraced testing describe it as a tool for making sure infections stay under control. But many school administrators see more hassle than benefit. Some states have turned down millions in federal funding for school-based virus testing. U.S. President Joe Biden faced fierce blowback from fellow Democrats and refugee advocates for considering keeping his predecessor's record low cap of 15,000 for admitting refugees this budget year. Biden ultimately raised the ceiling to 62,500, but in the end, resettlement agencies expect only 15,000 refugees to actually be admitted by September 30th. When the budget year ends and a new ceiling must be set by the president. The program was gutted by the Trump administration, and resettlement agencies say they lost valuable time to rebuild because of Biden's foot dragging. Refugee arrivals also have been hampered by coronavirus pandemic restrictions. Working long hours is killing hundreds of thousands of people a year in a worsening trend that may accelerate further due to the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the World Health Organization. In the first global study of the loss of life associated with longer working hours, the paper in Environmental International showed that 745,000 people died from stroke and heart disease associated with long working hours in 2016. That joint study produced by the WHO and the International Labor Organization showed that most of the victims were men and were middle-aged or older. Often the deaths occurred much later in life, sometimes decades later than a shift's work. It also showed that the people living in Southeast Asia, the Western Pacific region, a WHO-defined region which includes China, Japan, and Australia, were the most affected overall. It said that working 55 hours or more a week is associated with a 35% higher risk of stroke and a 17% higher risk of dying from heart disease versus a 35 to 40 hour work week. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 17. And here are some of the stories we are covering. An international conference on investment in Sudan opens today, Monday, in Paris, France.
Sudan is coming from out of 3 decades of kleptocracy under the regime of President Omar al-Bashir. And therefore, there are many problems that are root causes for the current economic crisis.
Zambia's ruling party suspends its public rallies. We'll have reaction from main opposition UPND. Zimbabwe's High Court delivers a setback for President Mnangagwa, and an Ethiopian opposition leader reacts to postponement of the June parliamentary election.
This election is not going to solve three fundamental problems of the country. One is the question of durable peace and stability. The second is the burden of democratic Ethiopia. The third is the meaningful economic development.
And Uganda strives to keep COVID-19 out of refugee population. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. High-level international conference on investment in Sudan begins today, Monday, in the French capital, Paris. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says in addition to drawing investments, the meetings will reintegrate Sudan into the international community, especially after Sudan had been removed from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism last December. Suleiman Baldo is a senior advisor on Sudan and the Horn of Africa at the Century, an investigative and policy group that follows the dirty money connected to African war criminals. He has just authored a report in which he says the Sudanese transitional government continues to make encouraging progress, but that such progress risks being undone unless it is routed in tangible shift away from the opaque and corrupt system under former President Omar al-Bashir.
Sudan is coming from out of 3 decades of kleptocracy under the regime of President Omar al-Bashir. And therefore, there are many problems that are root causes for the current economic crisis. One of them is the way the regime of the post-President Bashir has empowered companies that are owned by the government to be autonomous, to protect his regime, and to enrich those who are in the center of power under his regime. While Bashir has fallen, and what we are saying at the Century is that the economic crisis is caused in part the continued existence of companies that are owned by the state in Sudan, but that are refusing to submit themselves to the oversight and control of the Ministry of Finance in that country. And until this distortion is addressed, Sudan will continue to suffer from the siphoning of its resources. We are also making similar recommendations to the international community on how to support the efforts of Sudan as it tries to address these giant and powerful state-owned enterprises.
The new Sudanese government under Hamdong has taken some measures. What do you make of the measures that the government has taken so far?
The government has taken certain measures that address the distortions, such as the removal of subsidies on fuel, on electricity, and the unification of rate of exchange to a realistic rate of exchange between the national currency and the dollar. However, I personally think that the government has not done sufficient reforms to really maximize the collection of internal resources, particularly by reforming the tax system in Sudan, which is really lax in collection of taxes from those who, you know, should be taxed because of the levels of their income and their commercial operations or property ownerships and the like. Sudan collects less than 6% of taxes compared to its GDP to, double that percentage or even triple that percentage in average in comparable countries in Eastern Africa.
So what do you think should be the role of the international body that's part of this meeting? I'm talking in terms of United States, United Kingdom, the European Union. What should they be doing?
Well, the international community has committed to support the reform efforts of the civilian-led cabinet in Sudan. And they are promising, and part of the pledges of assistance that they promised have already been delivered. We want the international to continue supporting the economic reform efforts of the civilian-led government of Sudan, including by providing official development assistance and by facilitating private investments from their respective countries into Sudan. But for that to happen, Sudan needs to conduct serious reforms of the distortions that I described earlier in its economy, and the international community should definitively extend support to cushion the blow on the population.
Suleiman, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Suleiman Baldo is a senior advisor on Sudan and the Horn of Africa at the Century, an investigative and policy group. You are speaking with us from Washington, D.C. An Ethiopian opposition leader says the weekend postponement of the country's June 5th parliamentary elections means nothing because the election would not have solved Ethiopia's fundamental problems: one, peace and stability, democracy, and meaningful development. Ethiopia's Electoral Commission said Saturday that it postponed the election because it was having trouble with opening polling stations and voter registration. Merewa Gudina, chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress, says Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and his government were planning to have what he called electoral authoritarianism, which is having election for election's sake, as a means to get foreign aid.
This election is not going to solve three fundamental problems of the country. One is the question of durable peace and stability. The second is the birth of democratic Ethiopia. The third is the meaningful economic development. This election is not going to stand to solve those things. So it is a question of, I think, the ruling party is planning to have what we call in political science electoral authoritarianism. I repeat it, electoral authoritarianism. That means using elections as a showcase to the international communities to get foreign aid or whatever. And that will to look like good, the democratic thing that the West continue to give them the national aid and so on. Otherwise, to the citizens, it is really increasingly becoming meaningless. And in fact, one of the major issues of this postponement is that largely across the country, people have very little interest to register as voters.
I wanted to ask you that question because the commission, the Electoral Commission, said that one of the reasons they are now having the election is that it has not been able to finalize voter registration. Do you agree with that assessment? And what do you think is behind the commission not being able to register people?
People are really totally lost interest in the elections. And even those who have registered so far, a lot of them are one or another forced, coerced, and the registration was done in a lot of mischievous ways. You know, what we are planning to probably achieve is what during the Soviet era elections, you know, that Joseph Stalin used to say to the people of Russia, you know, you vote, we count. So the election board is really, literally sitting there for such an action, to give a cover to the ruling party. Now we have totally lost any confidence in that institution.
Because there's no specific date when the elections will be held again. What are the implications if there are no elections?
In fact, you know, everybody knows that the election is going to be meaningless, that is, as it now stands. And what the government is trying to do is to buy time, to create a situation where it can get some legitimacy by conducting some sort of an election. But I don't think the election is really going to be meaningful and going to solve the country's outstanding political problem.
There have been several media reports about the situation in the Tigray region, particularly the presence of Eritrean forces there. Some accounts have talked about human rights violation in the Tigray region. What do you know about Eritrean forces in the Tigray region and what's going on there?
Well, the Ethiopian government admitted their existence, but I think the problem they're now facing is that the Eritrean side resisting withdrawal. And my reading of the American delegation is that they are facing resistance from both the Eritrean and the Ethiopian side for quick withdrawal of the Eritrean forces from Ethiopia.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Okay, thank you too.
Merewa Gudina is the chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, says the decision Sunday by the ruling Patriotic Front, PF party, to suspend its public political rallies because of COVID-19 is a cheap political gimmick meant to deceive the public and the international community. The ruling party said Sunday that it was suspending public rallies because crowds and public gatherings are among the super spreaders of the COVID-19 virus. UPND spokesperson Cornelius Mwitwa says the decision is laughable because a week ago, President Edgar Lungu was dedicating development projects, including a new bridge and a police station, accompanied by large crowds.
For us, we take this as a cheap political gimmick, which is meant to hoodwink unsuspecting public, both local and international, into believing that the Patriot Front means well by way of respecting COVID protocols, hence banning election gatherings. If you check recent history, the president, Mr. Edgar Lungu, has been holding massive mammoth rallies when commissioning certain infrastructure projects, and his ministers have also been holding rallies around the country. What they are trying to do now is to say they are not going to hold rallies when they know, in fact, they will, as a matter of reality. And secondly, because they know that the public broadcasters are completely under their charge and control to such an extent that even if they are holding smaller meetings, they will be using those as their placards or billboards to be able to campaign.
The party secretary general, Mr. Mwila, quotes the Ministry of Health as saying that crowds and public gatherings are among the super spreaders of COVID-19 virus. This is a health precaution.
Yes, indeed, it is a health precaution. But when you look at COVID in Zambia generally, it hasn't been rife and it hasn't affected the community in a manner that it has done in many other countries. The recent survey, I think two, 3 days ago, there was about 4,800 tests. And out of 4,800 tests, I think those who were found to be COVID positive were less than 10. And even then, even when you would have 1,000 COVID positive tests, you find that the recovery rate is around 99%. I think we've been very fortunate, whether it is the weather in this part of the world, which is generally the savannah weather, which is generally, warm, or whether it is the type of immunity arising from the foodstuffs we eat, whether that has given some advantage to the genetic setup in terms of immunity. I think I'll leave that to the experts.
The elections are not until August 12. Do you suspect, or does the UPND suspect, that perhaps this decision by the Patriotic Front to suspend public rallies is a precursor to perhaps the government announcing a ban on public campaigning?
Well, anything goes with Patriot Front. You can't rule out the fact that they have been learning tricks from the likes of Uganda, who have been their mates from the time they came into office, the likes of Zimbabwe, a country where you have a leader who is not removed and you almost dying on the seat. These have been the closest allies of President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. But we do have faith in the people of Zambia. We do have faith in the realization that when Zambia wants to change, it changes against all odds.
Mr. Mwitwa, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me on VOA. Thank you.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa and the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 17. The High Court of Zimbabwe has ruled that the controversial reappointment of Chief Justice Luke Malamba is null and void, setting up a potential conflict with the government. Reuters reported Saturday that Justice Minister Ziyambi Ziyambe accused the judiciary of being captured by foreign forces seeking to destabilize the government. He said the court ruling was a typical case of overreach and that the Zimbabwe government could not accept it. Ade Gondo has more from Harare.
The High Court on Saturday overturned President Emmerson Mnangagwa's move to extend Chief Justice Luke Malaba's term as the country's top judge beyond his retirement age of 70. The judgment that Justices Happiest Joe Edith Mshore and Helena Sharewa issued Saturday means that Malaba's term in office ended when he turned 70 on Saturday, which is his birthday. There were two separate agent cases that were consolidated because they dealt with similar issues. The first one was filed by Musa Kika, who heads the Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum, a coalition of civil society organizations operating in Zimbabwe. The second was filed by the Young Lawyers Association of Zimbabwe, represented by Emma Drury. The applicants argued that the change was unlawful because it did not comply with the requirements of Section 328 of the Constitution, provision that specifies a special procedure for changing the Constitution. President Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party recently fast-tracked Constitutional Amendment No. 2 through Parliament. It allows the president to extend the term of office of senior judges on the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court by 5 years beyond the retirement age of 70 if they obtain a health certification from a medical practitioner. It also gives the president greater control over the selection of vice presidents. Some political analysts and legal experts see the court's ruling as a surprising but positive development for constitutionalism. The ruling also states that incumbent senior court judges cannot benefit from a constitutional amendment extending their terms past retirement age. Dirk Coltart is a human rights lawyer and he calls the ruling a victory for the rule of law.
What the High Court has done has simply declared what the position in the Constitution is, which is that an incumbent cannot benefit from any amendment which extends the time that a person may hold office. As such, Luke Malaba is no longer the Chief Justice and no longer a judge.
Some legal analysts and opposition politicians have criticized Malaba, who was appointed Chief Justice in 2017, for what they see as an attempt to rein in High Court judges by directing them to submit their judgments before delivering them. Coltart expects the ruling on Malaba to be appealed in an effort to have it suspended.
The JSC have already indicated that they do intend to appeal. Our respectful view is that that's not the case. The suspension of a High Court order is in respect of executable orders, but where there's a declaratory order such as this one, it will still stand, notwithstanding the noting of an appeal.
Coltart says that pursuing an appeal will deepen the constitutional crisis the country already faces because of the constitutional amendments that have been made. Political analyst Thomas Stoller says the judgment provides a glimmer of hope in an environment in which the executive essentially controls most arms of the government.
It's a victory for our constitution. It is a victory for our democracy, and it's a victory for all Zimbabweans. We know that Parliament right now is in paralysis. It's been captured by the executive. So there is no Parliament, as it were, in terms of exercising its oversight role. But this ruling gives at least a sense of relief to all Zimbabweans that indeed we still have men and women in the judiciary who can discharge their mandate in a professional manner.
Six of the Mnangagwa government say it is trying to undo the 2018 constitution and grab more power. However, earlier this month, government officials told VOA the constitutional amendments make it easier for the president to pick his vice presidents and ensure stability. Officials also said other countries allow heads of government to pick high court justices. In a statement last night, the Ministry of Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs indicated its intention to appeal the decision of the High Court, which analysts say risks pushing the country deeper into a constitutional crisis. Reporting for VOA, this is Ade Gondo in Blamayo, Zimbabwe.
Uganda's refugee population has reported no cases of COVID-19. In Bidibidi settlement, Yombi district, the refugee leaders are working tirelessly to maintain the status quo. Halima Athumani reports from Yombi in northern Uganda.
in Bangatuti Village, Bidibidi Settlement. Four Refugee Welfare Council members meet to discuss the awareness message to the community. When COVID-19 broke out in Uganda in March 2020, the Ugandan government quickly shut its door to new refugees, including those from South Sudan, to curb the spread of the disease caused by the coronavirus. According to the Johns Hopkins University, Uganda currently has more than 42,600 confirmed infections and 347 deaths. Data Kenyi, a Refugee Welfare Council member, says since then, the refugees have been closely monitored.
Tell them to observe the social distancing, hand washing. Them say just the SOPs put in place. There's no high rate infection in the settlement. Whoever came new has to go for 14 days quarantine. From there, then we join the community and be safe.
In the Ugandan refugee settlements, the markets, schools and health centers that are in zones closer to the local community are open to both refugees and locals. This can be a catalyst for the spread of COVID-19 if the refugees are not checked. Uganda has prioritized frontline health workers for the vaccine that is being administered around the country. At Abirimajio Market, which is open to refugees, Neva Rukia says she has heard on radio about people getting vaccinated and is wondering when they will be considered. She says they say that if you have not attained the age of 50, you won't get vaccinated. She also says, I'm 32 years and they say I don't qualify for the vaccination. Am I not at risk of being infected? Halima Athmani for VA News, Yumbe District, Northern Uganda.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the inaugural Basketball African League, which got underway on Sunday in Kigali, Rwanda. Former NBA player Ben Uzo became the first player to score in the newly created Basketball African League. But despite the history-making moment, Ben Uzo's side, Nigeria's Rivers Hoopers, were beaten by host Patriots Basketball of Rwanda 83-60. Brandon Kostner speaks after scoring 20 points in the Patriots' win.
It's awesome, man. This is the inaugural DAL tournament, and to come out for the home team and get the first win ever, the first win of the tournament, and to play well and have success, just an awesome feeling.
Action resumes on Sunday, but for the Patriots, they will resume their Group A campaign on Tuesday, facing Madagascar's GNBC, a team they beat twice in the BAL qualifiers. For the Hoopers, they will return to action on Wednesday against Tunisian champions US Monastery. In football news, Mamelodi Sundowns suffered a 2-0 loss in their CAF Champions League quarterfinal first leg match away to Al Ahly at the Al Salam Stadium in Cairo on Saturday night. The Brazilians, putting in a solid display in Egypt against a team managed by their former mentor, Pitso Mosimane, who described his former club, Mamelodi Sundowns, as a strong team.
The team is good. Mamelodi Sundowns' team is good. The team was created before I left, and I make sure that the team is very strong for Champions League, and I made sure that the team is strong for South Africa for the next 4 years.
In Johannesburg, Kaizer Chiefs thumped Simba SC of Tanzania 4-0 at the FNB Stadium in Johannesburg. Coach Gomez is the coach of Tanzania's Simba SC.
We are not enough tough for this kind of match. It's very important to be very aggressive, very tough, particularly in the goals. And about Kaizer Chiefs, we know very well that even if they are in a bad position in their local league, like I say before the match, Kaizer Chiefs is a very good team.
Elsewhere in Algiers, Algeria's CR Belouizdad took a major stride towards the final four of the CAF Champions League after defeating Osporons du Tunis 2-0 at the Stade du 5 Juillet 1962. Also at the same stadium, Mouloudia Club of Algiers scored a late equalizer to end a 1-1 draw against Wydad Casablanca on Friday evening. The aggregate winner will face either Kaizer Chiefs or Simba SC in the semifinals. In the CAF CAF Confederations Cup, Pyramids FC of Egypt claimed an emphatic 4-1 win over Enyimba SC of Aba in Sunday's 2020-2021 CAF Confederations Cup first leg quarterfinal action. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Button, Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.